control and order in the house. He was subject to long depressions, and over those years there were explosions of physical violence. Finally, in 1983, Charlotte asked for a divorce, and when that divorce went to court, there was a reporter from the Wall Street Journal watching the proceedings. The story that he eventually wrote about the Fetters led to John Fetter's resignation from the SEC and made Charlotte Fetters probably one of the nation's best-known victims of domestic violence, and since that time she has been talking about it a lot. She wrote the book, which was published last year by Harper and Row, and she continued to try to increase people's awareness of domestic violence. And she is here to talk with us this morning. She talked last night here in Champaign-Urbana and is going on tonight, and we'll be speaking over in Springfield. So we're pleased to have her here. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Your book is difficult to read. It's difficult to read about what you went through. It's been now since you were divorced 2 years?
Actually, I was just divorced officially in February of this year. When the book was written, I was still in the midst of many years of legal hassles to get divorced, but I've been divorced for about 8 months now.
And separated, maybe more like?
Separated 5 years since July of 83.
Is it difficult for you to talk about this still?
Not really. It's more therapeutic. I think more therapeutic years ago. But it's not too hard because it's behind me. And I know I'm helping people. It's an important issue. And when you've lived through it and survived, it's not as hard to talk about as you might think it would be.
Growing up, you grew up in a very traditional Catholic family, had what you might say was a relatively sheltered upbringing, were well cared for. Your father was a very strong man. Was he a domineering man?
He was domineering by his nature, but also he was the only man in the house. I had four sisters, and it's one of the things I explain when I speak. None of my friends even had any brothers. My grandfathers weren't around. I didn't have any. I had a few uncles, but I didn't see a whole lot of them. He was the total center of our life. He's a doctor, and his office is even in our home. So, I mean, our whole life revolved around my father. And in addition to that, he was a fairly strong individual who had not had the easiest life becoming a doctor. And so, therefore, he had learned to push himself around a little bit to get his way, and we tried to keep him happy. He had a temper, but he never hurt us. I mean, he never physically abused us or really emotionally abused us, but he did have a form of control in the house. So therefore, I was used to the man being the one in control, the one with the power.
Did that somehow, what life was like growing up for you, did that somehow help to form your impression of what married life was supposed to be and what you as a wife were supposed to be and how that relationship between husband and wife was supposed to go?
Yeah, oh, definitely. And my mother was very traditional. And again, she did everything for my father. And it's really all I wanted to do either. Also, I didn't want to be a professional. I went and became a nurse. But in the 60s and 70s, you were either a nurse or a teacher until you waited, until you got married and had children, stayed home and took care of the family. And so that it's what I saw, and it's really what I wanted.
When you tell me, when you met your husband, your former husband, you had not dated a lot of guys. You went to a Catholic girls' school when you were a girl. You went to a Catholic college.
All girls Catholic college.
All girls Catholic college. And this was when you were, I guess it was still part of your training, but you were working in a hospital,
right?
And happened to, and he was still in law school. He was going to a Catholic,
right? Catholic law university, school. Yeah.
So he was good Catholic boy. What were your impressions when you first met him?
Well, he was very tall. He's 6'10". I'm 5'9". I really never felt like I was particularly attractive. I always felt like I was really big. And so the first thing, of course, that attracted me to him was the fact that he was so much taller than I was. And he was very handsome and extremely charming. And frankly, I was just lucky. I mean, I felt lucky that he even talked to me. And then the first time he ever asked me out, it was like, oh my gosh, this is too good to be true. And then he asked me out a second time. I mean, I was just absolutely had a crush, you know, slash in love from absolutely the first time he ever talked to me. I felt just very lucky. And it was a theme that kind of, because I hadn't dated a lot, I thought it was a fluke. And so therefore, when I got into the marriage and things weren't really great, I immediately thought it was my fault that this wonderful person was acting this way. And I also felt that I wouldn't be able to live without him and no one else would want me. Certainly no one of that caliber, in quotation marks, would want me.
Yeah. You'd get, reading the story of your marriage and your relationship with John and the kind of person he was, it would be easy to assume that he was a monster. But that's the, you know, maybe the curious thing sometimes about people like that is that they may be monsters sometimes, but they're not monsters all the time. And it sounds as if there were, you know, maybe some aspects of your relationship with him that were good, at least good enough to try and carry you through the parts that weren't good.
Oh, definitely. They were the times that kept me in the marriage. The times when he wasn't abusive and wasn't wonderful were okay. But then there were some incredibly great times. Some of the experts refer to it as honeymoon periods. A lot of them did come in the I'm sorry phase after some kind of explosion, be it a physical explosion or at times emotional explosion, verbal explosion. He would be very sorry. Even my friends who, when they were listening to me talk, hated him. I mean, there was nothing redeeming about this man. They hated him. But then they'd see him. And one friend especially, she said, I bumped into him today, and she says, when you see him, he's really not bad. That's what another thing that's so confusing for many of the victims, because the outside world never sees him in the bad. And usually these men, I've heard other people speak, and one of the common threads that they all, you know, mention talking about these men and the personality is that they're so charming. And, you know, it sets up a real confusing state for victims because nobody else sees him the way he was. And he indeed showers some of the kindness and charm on you at times.
Mm-hmm. Before the first time that there was physical abuse, there may have been some times, well, I don't want to say there may have been some times, there were some times when he was an extremely difficult man to live with, but he was never physical. What happened that first time that he hit you, and what was your reaction?
To this day, and that was 20-some years ago, I'm still totally baffled by that time because we were discussing. And I was disagreeing with him. I was not screaming. As a matter of fact, I'll tell you right now, if I was screaming, my mindset was such at that point that I would have felt that I deserved some kind of, you know, attack on him, from him. We were just talking, but I was disagreeing, as I say, I guess strongly sticking to my point. I mean, I just wouldn't budge. And just his right hand just came to the left side of my face and hit me right smack on the ear, which broke my eardrum. One blow broke my eardrum, and I have never been so surprised at anything in my life. It would be, you know, almost walking past someone on a street and just, you know, having them turn around and hit you, you know, for no reason at all. And so I was quite surprised, very, very confused, because I really felt I had done nothing. I don't explain it well because I was just so surprised and I just didn't know where it had come from. And in years to come after that, I could pick out exactly what had made him mad. And of course, then I would try never to do that again. But this particular one, to this day, I don't know what did it. So I was very, very surprised. You're basically in a state of shock.
Yeah. After that had happened, you told your dad about it.
Not immediately, but I did tell my father. I sought medical care. I was too embarrassed to tell the doctor. I was sure that if I told him, he'd think, my Lord, what a bad person you are, that your husband would have to slap you. That may sound really ignorant to people listening, but it's a very common feeling that battered women have. I mean, I just felt this enormous guilt And I did tell my father somewhere, I don't know exactly the time frame, it was in the next couple months, and of course it was leave him, you know, yeah. I mean, just plain leave him. But as I said before, I went into the marriage, I grew up with not the greatest self-esteem. No one really knows why, but I didn't have it. And here I'd finally married this wonderful person, and I was sure that I couldn't comprehend living without a man, or at that point, very early into the relationship, living without him. So I couldn't just pick up and leave, and shortly thereafter I became pregnant.
As the time went along, were there a lot of other people who said that same thing that your father said, that you want to leave this guy, or did you not tell very many people what was going on?
From until 1973, so it would be about 6.5-7 years into the marriage, I really didn't tell too many people because I was moving around a lot. We moved from, you know, New York City to Westchester County. From Westchester County, about a year and a half later, we moved to Texas, and from Texas we moved to Washington, D.C., where we stayed. So once I got to Washington and really had a group of friends that I, you know, knew well after a couple years, then I started telling people. But basically the first close to, you know, 8 years, I would periodically mention it to some family member, but I didn't have many friends because I was isolated, and not necessarily by him. A lot of men do isolate their women in other forms, but in the beginning it was just the way things were that I was somewhat isolated because we weren't any place long enough to really get, you know, friends that I would confide in. So I had a long history in the marriage of not telling people except, like I said, every now and then mentioning to my family, eventually to his family. His family's theory was, well, you just better get some help to learn to live with him. You know, I was reaching out to them to see if they could initiate some change in him. I did go to several psychiatrists. I told, you know, a doctor about a pregnancy beating. So I told some people, but not really close friends. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the psychiatrist and the doctor, the one doctor said to leave him, the psychiatrist tried to change me. And so there were times that John would yell at me and say that I was the crazy one, go look in the mirror. And, you know, I stopped and think about it. I was the one who was going to the psychiatrist. I was the one with the diagnosis. So therefore, I accepted the fact that I was the sick one very easily.
Yeah, that's really, that really sticks in my mind that, you were trying to live with this man and who was subject to these explosions of violence, but also was subject to really prolonged periods of depression, and you were trying to get through to him and figure out what was going on with him, and for him at that period to say to you, well, you know what our problem is, go look in the mirror and you'll see. It must have been really devastating.
It was, and I'll jump way up to divorce proceedings, which I think is not even in the book because a lot has taken place in the past year. Just about a year ago right now, we had to go into court for what I thought was the final divorce. I eventually had to appeal it, but he convinced a judge in Montgomery County, Maryland, that he had had depressions and that I didn't emotionally support him during the depressions, and therefore the judge ruled that I was equally to blame for the breakup of the marriage. Equally, not even partially, equally. And, you know, getting in... tell you, because some people may have heard about it, there was a book ruling that he, because of this, and because of marital property being divided and everything, he was given a portion of the book proceeds, which eventually was overturned. But so, like I said, you know, he was very convincing that I hadn't supported him, and it was very frustrating because all these years I was trying to support him, and I was trying to find out what was the matter, and I was being told by him to go look in the mirror. There was that problem.
Well, it also, and probably other women have confronted the same circumstance, as you went along trying to, you went to various counselors, you talk with a lot of people. You said a little bit earlier that you were, that the first time that he hit you, you were afraid to tell the doctor what happened because you were afraid the doctor would say, well, what did you do to, the problem is that all along, you seem to be getting messages from the people that you were talking to that somehow you were the problem, that you had to be a different person, you had to feel better about yourself, you had to learn how to live with him better, not to trigger these things off, and that there was there anybody or very many people who said, look, this guy is bad news, there's nothing that you can't improve yourself, you'd get out of the situation.
Well, my parents and friends, without really saying that, they felt there should be some separation. But of the professionals, and you never believe parents or friends. You know, you have to believe the professionals. No professional said that. You know, they all, like I said, tried to change me and let me, figuring that if my reaction to him changed, then surely he would change. So no, not until 1982, when I finally met a psychologist that said, this is wrong, and you're not the one that's bad. You know, he's driving you crazy, but you're not the one who's bad.
Yeah. We're talking this morning with Charlotte Fetters about her experiences as an abused wife. She wrote about it in her book, Shattered Dreams, published in 1987 by Harper & Row. And she was in the area to do some speaking and was good enough to come over and spend some time talking with us, both about her experiences and about domestic violence in a more general sense. We're here open to questions, as always. So if you'd like to talk with Charlotte, you can do that by picking up the telephone, 333-9455, toll-free in Illinois, 800-222-9455. I don't want this question to come out sounding like blaming the victim, because it might. But before the first time there was physical violence, and you know, thinking back about the period before you got married and the years of your marriage leading up to that, were there signs that, looking back now, you could say, well, those were keys to his character that might have led you to suspect that he was the kind of person he was?
There were keys to suspect to lead me, now again looking back on it, that he was going to be controlling and want things his own way. But nothing, I've searched, nothing to indicate that if he didn't get his own way, he would become physically violent. Actually, the emotional control ended up being worse, but that was there very early. When we were doing interviews for the book, friends remembered me coming down, you know, dressed up in something, you know, for a date, and he'd say, I don't like that blouse, and I'd rush right back upstairs to change it. There was also a period that he didn't speak to me. He kissed me goodnight one night and said, bye, I'll see you tomorrow morning, or call you tomorrow. And
This was before we were married,
and 8 weeks later he showed up again. I mean, he called, and then there was no explanation for the withdrawal, nothing. He had to study, which I would have understood, but that, you know, that's what his excuse was. So there were signs of the emotional, but none of the physical. He never pushed. He never threatened me with a fist. You know, it just wasn't there. And there had been none in his family or my family. Therefore, I also, that was something else, I had never seen it. And because I had never seen it, I just figured this was something, again, that was really wrong with me, because why would someone do this? You know, you spank your children. I don't anymore. But that was the only physical violence, in quotation marks, I had ever seen or heard of, is people spanking their children because the children were bad. Well, if I was being spanked or disciplined physically, therefore I was bad.
Mm-hmm. But something else that I'd like you to talk about, it's in so much detail in the book, it would be difficult to really impress upon people the extent of it, but just to give people an idea, the way the household ran, John was, I think, obsessed is a fair word.
Well, he admits that he was
obsessed with order and everything being in a certain way, and everything always being the way he wanted it. Again, the thing that sticks out in my mind again is the thing about how he liked to see the marks from the vacuum cleaner and the carpet all going the same way.
Yeah, and he didn't want any little footprints, and I eventually had six little footprints, you know.
But you had to make sure that the kids took off their right. shoes before they came inside?
Yeah, one of the things my little toddlers learned, and I had six children. One died at a year and a half, but I ended up having six little children. As soon as they learned to, you know, walk and put on their shoes, they learned to take them off. I mean, we did not wear shoes in our home. One of the worst beatings I ever got was because I challenged him and stomped my feet in front of him and said, I'm going to wear shoes in my own home if I want to. The house had to be very clean. There was, you know, the kids could mess up the basement. But, you know, periodically we'd have to go down and give it such a cleaning that it wasn't worth messing it up. You know, he very proudly announced on the stand that he had an anal personality. I mean, he's very, very pleased with that point. So it wasn't really a very relaxed household, that's putting it mildly. And then in addition to the way the household had to be run, I had certain duties. People would really call it like slavish type duties. I mean, I had to help him get dressed in the morning, and I mean, I had to lay out his clothes. I had to help tie his tie if he wore a bow tie. I had to hook up suspenders. I had to, you know, carry his coat, put his wallet in his coat, wash his glasses, you know, put the hanky in his pocket of his coat. I remember several times he would take it out, and I would feel, oh, you know, I failed because he had to reinsert the hanky in his pocket. You know, it was just that type of thing. And it's funny, when you really say it, it almost sounds insignificant, but on a daily basis, when you couldn't not do it, when I finally stopped doing it in 1982, I was selfish. And he just was beside himself that I was no longer participating in this type of activity. And I mean, I would go in and I would be nursing a baby, and I would have to put the baby down. I would have to stop nursing to hook up his suspenders or go through this routine. So it's like once I started something for him, I wasn't allowed to stop it. I had to pack for him, and I mean, literally, we couldn't take phone calls after five. You know, after he came home in the evening, it was a hard life. It was a very hard thing to live with, and you never knew what was going to trigger him. You know, it's a myth that only guys who abuse alcohol or drugs, you know, come home drunk, then you know to stay away from them. You know, wish it was that easy. It isn't. Those guys, by the way, will also come home and still batter their women, whether or not they're high or on, you know, or drunk. So there was no way of predicting it.
We're talking about some of the experiences of our guest, Charlotte Fetters, and again, they're detailed in her book. It was published last year, Shattered Dreams. Yes, yeah. It's now in paperback?
Yeah, it is. It just came out. Normally, I don't plug my book, but it did just come out in paperback.
And is it same publisher?
No, Dell.
Dell,
I mean, literally this week.
Yeah, okay. We're talking this morning with Charlotte Fetters about her experiences as a victim of domestic violence, and you can read about them in her book, Shattered Dreams, which has just been published in paper now, published by Dell. Well, we do have some callers here, and I will not keep them waiting any longer. We'll go right to the phones, and first to line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
How long were you married to this idiot?
We were together for just about 17 years. I was actually married 21 and a half, but we were together for 17.
Why didn't you just say, forget it, take the kids, and go?
That's always a hard question. I should have done it the first time, and it's what I tell people. You know, what should you do? You have to make a change in the cycle immediately. You have to remember the way I felt about myself. I think I said it earlier, I really didn't feel that any other man would want me. I didn't feel capable. I very, very early in the relationship, he had me beaten down, that I did not feel capable of taking care of myself. It's kind of one step builds on the other. It's not just the physical violence, it's the emotional control over you, or jerking around, if you want to call it that, that also accompanies this, and it very quickly makes you to the point that you really aren't thinking clearly. I often said I became a non-person. I didn't. It's like the it's a learned helplessness type of thing. It's like the mouse that comes out. Every time he comes out of the corner, he's shocked. Well, eventually, he doesn't come out of the corner. So, you know, I wasn't a very strong, rational person who could say, hey, take the kids and run. I was very beaten down and emotionally paralyzed.
Well, did he abuse you in other physical ways other than just beatings? I don't know. That's the nicest way. I don't know how to say it on the air.
Every now and then. There are a couple episodes of basically, I've learned now, marital rape, but nothing worse, if you want to call it, you know, than that. But usually it was the physical, but the emotional again was worse for me. mean, when you're called every crazy name in the book, and you're, you know, there's never a day that you look right, or and if you do, then you know, well, where are you going? Type thing. Why'd you get fixed up? And when it's a constant monitoring of your every breath, it's very emotionally demoralizing.
Well. You know, 17 years is a long time. You know, that's almost masochistic to say that.
Well, there are people who feel that, and that's a myth. Women do not enjoy this. They are locked in and isolated and trapped, again, mostly because of the emotional control. That's just plain hogwash that anyone would enjoy this type of behavior. But it's very hard to explain. I've been out of it for this many, you know, 5 years now, and I still have a hard time explaining. I've actually seen training films that show the emotional abuse that just recently that so emotionally overtook me I could barely speak. So it's very subtle also. You don't know what's happening. And then by the time it has happened, and by the time you realize it, you just are too stuck in it. It takes a very strong person to break it. And in my case, I didn't break the cycle because of the fact that I felt I deserved better. I just finally realized that it was, you know, really affecting my children, especially my oldest child at that point, who's almost 4 years older than the other group. And once it started affecting my children, then I had to say it was enough. But I really didn't even, I'll be honest with you, I didn't get out because I felt I deserved better. I got out because I knew my children didn't deserve to be treated like this.
How was he with the kids, as he was with you?
Well, he was wonderful with the children until they started thinking for themselves. So sometime around the age of 6 or 7, he started getting into trouble, especially with my oldest one, because Luke would have a certain way of looking at things, as we No children do. They don't always think the way we would like them to think. And he would not accept that. And so he eventually became very, very hard on my oldest son, who's now 19 and who has spent 5 years in and out of therapy getting himself together and feeling good about himself. Luke felt like nothing. And so, yes, he did do it to my children. And he was, the next two were coming up. They were like 9 and 10, so they were beginning to challenge him also. And so, in effect, he treated them the same way he treated me. When we have these long silences, he did not just not speak to me. He would walk past his 5 children and not say a word. My oldest son broke his hand once. The hand was broken in a cast, healed out of a cast, before he even said, "How did you break your hand?" So, I mean, yes, he treated the children the same way.
Okay, well, let's talk with someone else here. Line number 2, our next person. Hello.
Hello. First, I'd like to congratulate the author on her disclosures. I think that's really important, and she's doing a good job. And I heard something a little bit earlier that struck my awareness. You said that you had a child 1 and a half who died.
Right.
I was curious if you were suspicious of the causes.
No, absolutely not. It was meningitis, and there was, you know, it was clear-cut infection. So as a matter of fact, that was a time that I really hoped that things would change. It was certainly something that is difficult, an insignificant word to explain, you know, what it's like to bury a child. And I really had felt that it changed my way of thinking, and I hoped it would change John's, but it didn't. But no, he was not a beater of his children. He was more the emotional jerking around. He would very openly spank, in quotation marks, his children with a large fraternity paddle. I mean, that was his way of discipline. And I realize now that really is a form of violence, physical violence, but...
Yeah, if I were to do that to someone walking down the street, I'd be arrested for assault.
Well, and especially he's a 6'10" fellow, and he actually to this day, he only sees 2 of my children, and one of them, a 7-year-old, is again beginning to challenge him, and he'll spank him with just his hand, but he'll say, I didn't hurt him. You know, I mean, he just never realized his power or strength. And, you know, when you're shoved or just slapped by a guy who's that big, he's like, weighs 230, 240, you're hurt, period. And you couldn't go down and if someone who worked for you didn't do a good job, you couldn't whip out the fraternity paddle and slap him and get away with it. So, you know, it is a form of physical violence. But I never suspected that there was, like I said, this was clear-cut meningitis and the death of John Michael.
Have the rest of your children sought therapy for their emotional difficulties?
Yeah, it you know, I have such a wide range of children. The three older ones have had some form of therapy, but then I dropped down to a 10-year-old who only saw one episode when he was three, and a 7-year-old whose father left when he was two. So they haven't had anything yet. I think they might have to eventually, just to accept, because they will eventually know, and actually they do know a little bit about what their father did, but they will eventually have it explained to them, and they will need some form of therapy. But yes, they've all had, they're very easy to, we have a family therapist that, when they have any problems, anything they want to talk about, they just go make an appointment with Dr. Donahue. I mean, it's like going to the dentist. That's how, and it's really kind of a great way to be, that we're comfortable with seeking, emotional guidance.
Absolutely. Well, good on all of you. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you. Let's go on here to someone else. We have a caller on our toll-free line. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. This problem happens to exist in my family, and it manifests itself in two ways. Both the father, in this case, has this behavior towards his wife. And then they have a son that ever since he's been little has been very harsh. In other words, he's very physical and goes through these violent periods periodically, if you know what I mean, without any rationale. He just suddenly seems to sort of imitate his father's behavior. Now, my question is this a physiological or a psychological problem with the man that is doing this?
Well, I think it can actually be both. I won't say either. I think it can be both. The people who have dealt with me really feel that my former husband had some, physiological problem, but he also had the other problem. I don't think you can really separate them. In regards to the child, it sounds like, yes, there may be some, physiological reason why he is acting that way. But statistics hold that, I think it's somewhere between 70 and 90, it depends on whose statistics you're reading, 70 to 90% of boys grow up to be batterers did see it in their family. So it is a type of learned behavior. And, I personally feel it's very difficult to separate the two. But the bottom line is, if they see it as a child, many, many men will grow up to be batterers or be very controlling people in their relationships with their family.
Do you have any knowledge of this? Is this particular behavioral manifestation reversible? Is there any form of treatment that can liberate this behavior?
There is. Matter of fact, any of the shelter or the abused persons organizations would be able to, to guide you in that direction. However, it is very difficult. It's a very difficult pattern of behavior to break. And there's still differing views on how you should handle an abusive man. But yes, I mean, to answer your question, it can be broken, but it is very, very difficult pattern to break. I personally feel that a man has to really want to break it. There are some people who say that even if a man is court-ordered to go to counseling, that many times that will at least break the cycle of violence. It may not necessarily break the need to control, especially that particular family, but it might, break the cycle of physical violence. But it's very difficult.
Thank you very, very much.
Thank you. Again, our telephone number is 333-9455, toll-free in Illinois, 800-222-9455. We're talking with Charlotte Fetters about her experiences with domestic violence. She's written about them in the book Shattered Dreams, first published in 87 and is now out in paperback. If you'd like to talk with her again, share your thoughts with us, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Was in your former husband's childhood, was there abuse in his family?
No, there was no alcohol. There was no physical abuse. There was one controlling person in his family, which is his mother. Being a mother, I wouldn't want everything blamed on me when my children grow up, so I can't blame it all on her. He has blamed it on her. And he has chosen psychoanalysis as a form of therapy. I believe across the board, almost every expert in domestic violence will tell you that is the wrong treatment, because he has been able to shift the blame from himself to his mother and then from his mother to me. But she was a very controlling person, but certainly not enough to create this type of behavior pattern. And there was no physical abuse, as far as I can see, as far as I can look back, nothing that he ever saw. And so, therefore, he is the minority. But that, you know, it goes to prove that you do not have to see it. Yes, if you do see it, you usually grow up to be that way. But as a man, but if you don't see it, you can still fall into that pattern.
You were growing up with very strong Catholic. As we talked about before, you went to Catholic schools, all Catholic girls' schools, and that was very strong in your family and was very important to you. Did you find at any point support from the church, or did you try to seek some help there?
Yes, I did. I eventually, you know, very humbly crawled to my pastor, figuring since John was basically, I would look back at, you know, feel almost much stronger Catholic, at least in the, you know, the outside world, stronger Catholic than I was, or more neurotic Catholic, I think. I'll be honest. I felt that surely he'd listen to a priest, so I did, you know, tell the pastor once, and this man listened to me. He talked to John, and he came back and said that John just needed some space and I should go home and love him. So that's what I got from the Catholic Church, and that was as late as, I think, 1978, something like that. It was not just, you know, it wasn't way back at the beginning. I eventually did find a priest much later that, you know, said this guy's a little nutty and this is not, you know, the proper behavior. But basically I didn't get a whole lot of support from the church. I didn't really seek it. But, you know, when you finally seek the help from someone and the door is kind of slammed in your face and shifted, the blame is kind of shifted back to you, you don't go back.
Yeah. You get to the point where you just stop talking about it.
Yeah.
We have another caller here on our toll-free line again. We'll go there. Hello.
Hi. There are two aspects. I don't know whether you have tackled them yet in the program, but one of them is the traditional method of making marriages work, which probably occurred before you actually got married. But I can remember when we used to put women on a pedestal. I grew up in the old tradition of the working husband and the full-time mother, but we were socialized back in those days to place women on a pedestal, and it was very rare, at least in my experience, and I used to deliver newspapers, so we used to read the newspapers every morning before we would deliver them. I was very, very rarely ever a domestic violence case, because in those days, young men were socialized to see women as special, and there was strong cultural disapproval toward any boy who would exercise violence toward a girl, or any man who would exercise any kind of violence toward a woman. We've kind of lost that tradition. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that was possibly the tradition to the outside world. I think the traditionalism gets into, I'll keep you on a pedestal as long as you are the traditional wife and you obey my rules. What I'm getting at is I think there was a lot more violence there than we were willing to talk about. I mean, heck, I mean, I'm considered this rebel almost that's talking about it now in the late 80s. I think there was more there than we accept.
I often hear that explanation, that there was really more there, but in those days we had never heard of a woman's violence sanctuary for women of victims of violence. We didn't need any.
Well, we needed them. We just didn't, you know, we needed them. It's just that the women weren't going out because of the traditional background. She was there to keep, the tradition was, the wife ran the house and kept the guy in the house happy.
Yeah, well, wouldn't we have seen the women with the black eyes and the bruises? Wouldn't they have shown up somewhere?
I think they were there. I think these were the women that just didn't go out or, you know, wore the sunglasses. I think they were there or said they, you know, they fell or they, you know, bumped into doors. I mean, I'm fairly traditional. When I was certainly early in the marriage, and or for most of the marriage, and they're the things that I did because I just knew that this wouldn't be happening to me, and especially very upper middle class, it wouldn't be happening to me if I hadn't done something wrong. This was my job, and if I was getting this type of behavior, then obviously I wasn't doing my job well. I really believe that. It was there. The problem was there. It's just that women's consciousness, I guess, hadn't been raised, and so we had, you know, we didn't go out and go to shelters.
Now there is a reasonable sociological explanation as to why, if children have grown up in a situation of domestic tranquility, they will not resort to violence, and that is that. When children have grown up in a tranquil, well-functioning two-parent family, they actually have years of experience in making marriage work before they get married. In other words, they have seen marriage modeled for them. And now, in today's world, where we have families of all different structures, and sometimes, as often as not, dysfunctional, children grow up and arrive at marriage age with having never seen a successful marriage modeled. What do you think of that?
Well, I disagree with that too, because I mean, yes, that I guess would hold true with some people, but domestic violence didn't just hatch in the past couple of years. It you know, the people who are battering now, they saw their family batter. It's not just because they were from a one parent or, you know, dysfunctional household. I have a one parent household now, and I know that my children are in a much stronger, much better home, much more functional home than they were when they were in the other one with a father, and to the outside world with a father who was a very good provider. So, you know, it's just, I'd like to think that life was as tranquil and peaceful as you portray it, but it hasn't been quite that way for all these years.
We're starting to run out of time, and I've got a couple of other callers I want to get to. We only have 5-6 minutes. I know the time ends up going very, very quickly, and I wish that we had more, but we'll just have to end when the time comes. We'll see if we can get both these other people here in before we finish. Here, line number one is next. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I wanted to say that I agree with your speaker that these people who are battering now had to have learned it from somebody. And I can recall growing up and hearing euphemisms, hearing marriages whispered about, and it would say things like, she's just staying with him because of the children. And she really had no option, no way to support herself to get her children away from a battering, bad husband. I had friends whose parents were talked about like this, and these were people whose parents were in my mother's generation, the same generation this man is talking about. Those women had to put the best facade on things because they couldn't. There was no way that they could support themselves and take care of their children away from the marriage, and they just put up with the battering until the children were grown and they could somehow get away or hope that things got better then. Those kids learned it from their fathers, the same generation of people that this man is talking about. It was just very well hidden.
Well, I agree, and we also we used to laugh about it. I mean, look at the honeymooners. I mean, you know, Ralph would raise his fist and you know, threaten Alice that she's going to the moon someday, and we all laughed. I don't think that's funny anymore. I mean, you know, it's the old vaudeville joke, when did you stop beating your wife? Well, who said I ever did? You know, it's like, it was there. It was there. It's just that it was a very, very silent crime, and you were almost criticized, certainly by men, if you broke the taboo and did speak about it.
Well, let's take another caller here, line number two. Hello.
Yes.
I just wanted to add further credence to that same thing from anecdotal examples in our own family. I have an older family member who's 75 years old who has told me many stories of what it was like as a young woman and growing up among her peers, and where this man says he didn't see anything and you didn't know about it. You didn't, because she told me stories of young women that she knew at that time who were bruised and battered, who would wear long-sleeved dresses and high collars and carefully make their faces up so that the battering would not show and that they could go to church on Sunday and no one would know that. And interestingly enough, these same families we're still aware of today who have children in their 40s and 50s and perhaps grandchildren in their 20s, many of these children and these families today have these same tremendous problems with battering and tremendous emotional problems with their own children. So it was there then, it does go on, and I think there's a lot of affirmation for what she's saying. And if this gentleman didn't see it before, it's simply because he wasn't able to.
And that also brings up a point, which you said, many men, even in the heat of anger, will batter in areas that are easy to cover up.
One of the things that I want to ask, and maybe we have really answered the question, your situation got a lot of attention. You wrote the book, and during your divorce trial, there happened to be a reporter there, a reporter from Wall Street Journal. He wrote a story that appeared in the paper and led your former husband had to resign his position at SEC and sort of made you a national figure. For good or ill, but you know, we've been talking about your particular case. How does what happened to you generalize? I mean, does it mean more than just this was your life?
Oh, it happens to a lot of people, and there's a fairly common thread. It doesn't matter where you live, or basically how old you are, or your financial position in life, the things that happen to us and the dynamics of family violence are almost always the same. I have heard from, actually most of the letters I get are from upper middle class women, most of whom usually say something like, you know, we were married to the same man. That's how common my story is. And then many times when I speak, like last night when I spoke, there were several shelter inhabitants there, and they were, you know, beautiful young women who haven't necessarily had all the financial benefits that I have had, but yet their stories were the same. You know, the dynamics are pretty much the same no matter, you know, who you are.
I got one more person I want to try and get in here on the toll-free line. If you can, try and make your question pretty quick for us.
Yes, I will. Hello.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I called to play the devil's advocate, if I may. I think of your husband as a huge, gross figure of a man, and I picture him when you're in the supermarket or at the shopping centers, and little kids looking up and say, "Mama, see that giant, see that huge person." Or maybe a young girl is too kind of looking and wondering, "What was this anyhow? Is it human or what is it?" That's all I have to say. Could you make a little comment on that?
You mean as if, well, I will make a comment. I think this might be along what you're saying. John's height, perhaps just, and I do think it increased his poor self-esteem. I mean, people think, oh, he's so tall. Well, that's a lot to live with. That's another fairly common thread. They're trying to, you know, figure out who the typical, quotation marks, batterer is. I don't think they really have one. However, a common thread is usually they don't think so highly of themselves. And I think possibly that's what the caller was indicating, that, you know, maybe that had some effect on his you know, behavior. But it's certainly not an excuse. I mean, there are a lot of, you know, tall guys that don't batter. There are a lot of short guys that, you know, do. So, you know, but they basically also have a poor self-esteem, poor self-image themselves.
We will just have to leave it at that. Thanks very much for talking
with
us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Charlotte Fetter is our guest, and you can read her story in the book Shattered Dreams. It was first published last year in hardcover by Harper & Row, and now has just come out in paper by Dell.